have left about what we are seeing right now from MAGA Trumpism. Excellent voicemail. All right. On the bonus show today, the Supreme Court has effectively abolished the right to mass protest in three states. I'll tell you which three states and we will discuss it. Number two, a number of Democratic Senate candidates are out fundraising their Republican opponents. It's not just Biden outraising Trump. It's happening down ballot. What does it portend for what's to take place in November? And the next level of deep fakes is now here. Real time deep fake romance scams are here. How to avoid falling for them. There's one surefire way, but we'll get to that. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
I implore you to grab a membership at joinpacman.com. We're trying to grow our support from 0.5% to 1% of our audience. Help us get there. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Use the coupon code SAVEDEMOCRACY24 if you would like to.
Thank your lucky stars. Every day you're not Dave Pacman.
And take Alex Jones' advice. Thank your lucky stars every day you're not Dave Pacman. We'll see you on the bonus show. Elon Musk's Tesla expected to lay off more than 10% of its workforce. And everybody is seeing in this what they want to ascribe politically, either to Elon Musk or to electric vehicles. I think both interpretations are wrong here, and I want to discuss it. CNBC reporting, Dow surges more than 100 points as strong retail sales and earnings overshadow the Iran-Israel conflict. But one company that is not doing so well is Tesla. Tesla will lay off more than 10% of its global workforce. And it gives access, the article does, to an Elon Musk memo that refers to preparing the company for the next phase of growth, looking at cost reductions, increasing productivity. And indeed, there is going to be a more than 10% layoff of Tesla staff. Now, let me give you a couple different perspectives on this that are being floated, none of which I think really captures what's going on. And I say this, I'm going to give this disclaimer, even though people said I no longer have to because I no longer own the stock. Some people still think I do. I used to own Tesla stock. I sold all of it. Okay. I still drive a Tesla for a few more months, but then my lease is over and I'm getting almost certainly something different. So this has nothing to do with my personal connection to Tesla. And quite frankly, I had such a relatively small amount of stock anyway. It doesn't even really matter. There are some who really don't like Elon Musk and are saying this is what Elon Musk has caused. Elon Musk has ruined Tesla. It's terrible. He ruined it just like he ruined Twitter by turning it into X and all of the things that are going on. So the 10% layoff is simply because Elon Musk sucks. I don't think that's actually the situation in this particular case. The other side of this is because electric vehicles are terrible. The technology is no good. The cars are no good. You can't drive far, like Trump likes to say. This is an indictment of electric vehicles in general. I think that is also the wrong interpretation. I think that this has very little to do with Elon Musk and with electric vehicles as the problem, and everything to do with how comparatively Tesla is starting to not have the very obvious first mover advantage that it once did. It is still the case that with few exceptions, when it comes to range, Tesla is at the top when it comes to electric vehicles, although increasingly, and especially with 2025 model years, there will be lots of good competition in terms of vehicle range. That's not good for Tesla, but Tesla vehicles still have great range. When it comes to the charging network, Tesla still has the best charging network. Some other companies are being given access to it. Rivian vehicles, for example, I believe now can start using Tesla superchargers, but it is still the case that Tesla, as far as charging for longer trips, is the most convenient rather than dealing with level two chargers, which can take 7 hours to fill up the battery in a significant manner. You've got Tesla superchargers, 15, 20 minutes and off you go. The issue here is that as more people realize that for 95% of their driving, they don't need superchargers. You can just charge at home because you're not driving far enough that you're exceeding the range of the vehicle. As people realize, I actually don't need the Tesla supercharger network except for long road trips, which most people don't do. And as people realize that the build quality of Teslas, in my opinion, still leaves a little something to be desired. And there are legacy automakers that have been making cars for much longer that make really good cars. I have friends now who regularly say to me, sir, I test drove a Tesla and a Hyundai Ioniq, and I like the Ioniq better. It felt more solid, and I like the service availability of Hyundai dealerships or whatever the case may be. At the higher end, so many people that say to me, you know, I test drove the Model X.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
After 7 months, that's it. We are all waiting for death, one by one. We don't know when and how. Children like these, the majority of them are children. We pull them out and we can't tell them apart. We don't know who is left under the rubble.
As warplanes continue to bomb Gaza and the death toll nears 34,000, we go to Cairo, Egypt, to speak with a Palestinian photographer who left Gaza 10 days ago with his family. Then a picture by a Palestinian photojournalist in Gaza wins the 2024 World Press Photo of the Year. We look at the Gaza Collective Photo Essay Project.
Palestinian photojournalists are the only ones, are the only window into the suffering of people in Gaza. And so it was really important for us to go to them and to try to share and elevate again the incredible, tragic testimonies that they are reporting and covering day in, day out for the last 6 months.
And the internationally renowned feminist Palestinian professor, Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian, reinstated by Hebrew University, is arrested by Israeli police in her Jerusalem home. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel launched a drone attack on Iran, according to Israeli and Iranian sources. Tehran said the strike hit a military airbase near the city of Isfahan, where explosions could be heard. The damage was reportedly minimal, and Iranian forces later downed 3 Israeli drones. The attack early this morning came in response to Iran's recent drone and missile attack on Israel. It comes less than 3 weeks after Israel attacked an Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, killing many people, including senior military officials. About a dozen people were killed. There were early reports of possible strikes inside Syria and Iraq as well, but those have not been confirmed. Earlier Thursday, the U.S. announced new sanctions on Iran targeting its missile and drone programs and various military entities and individuals. The EU and the U.K. are also imposing new sanctions against Iran. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at a G7 meeting in Italy earlier today, the U.S. was not involved in any offensive operation by Israel, though it's reported the U.S. received advance notice of the Israeli attack on Iran. Here in New York, riot police moved in on a peaceful student protest encampment, arresting at least 108 people at Columbia. Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq called the NYPD to clear the Gaza Solidarity encampment on the campus's South Lawn, where Columbia and Barnard students had set up one day earlier to demand university leadership divest from Israel. New York Police Chief John Schell said Shafiq identified the demonstration as a clear and present danger, but that officers found the students to be peaceful and cooperative. Shafiq warned all students participating in the encampment would be suspended if arrested. At least 3 suspensions of Barnard students were confirmed Thursday, including Isra Hirsi, daughter of Congressmember Ilhan Omar. Columbia students and faculty members held a news conference Thursday evening. This is Palestinian-American graduate student Leila Saliba, who lost 14 family members in Gaza since October 7th.
Today was a dark day for freedom of speech on Columbia's campus. Because Columbia is showing that if you do not if you say something or do something that the university does not agree with, that they are willing to use violence towards you, and that they are willing to endanger the health and safety and well-being of their students to protect their PR and their image.
That's right.
Right here, we've got some riot cops. Look right over there. They're treating us like a national security threat simply for holding a press conference.
Leila Salibo was also one of the Columbia students attacked in January's chemical skunk attack during a campus rally. Following yesterday's arrest, students continued to gather on campus where large protests carried on through the night and are ongoing. Thursday's showdown with the NYPD was the largest arrest on the Columbia campus since 1968, when police apprehended over 700 students protesting the school's ties to the Vietnam War and Columbia's plans to expand in Harlem by building a gymnasium in Morningside Park. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, massive crowds of students at the University of Southern California protested USC's cancellation of valedictorian Asna Tabassum's graduation speech, chanting, "Let her speak." This is student Katya Urban.
It feels really important, especially right now, for the Jewish voice at USC, the anti-Zionist Jewish voice at USC, to be very loud and very present. So we're here just to support Asna and to support free speech and to hold USC accountable.
To see our interview with the USC valedictorian, go to democracynow.org. The United States was alone in vetoing a UN Security Council resolution Thursday recommending Palestine's full membership at the United Nations. The UK and Switzerland abstained. All 12 other nation members voted in favor of Palestinian membership. Palestine is currently a non-member observer. Riyad Mansour, Palestinian ambassador to the UN, said the result will translate to a greater loss of life in Gaza. He spoke after the vote.
Our right to self-determination has never once been subject to bargaining or negotiation. Our right to self-determination is a natural right, a historic right, a legal right, a right to live in our homeland, Palestine, as an independent state that is free and that is sovereign.
More details have emerged about the death of Hind Rajab, the 6-year-old girl in Gaza City who was killed by Israeli forces in January in a car alongside 5 of her family members. Prior to her death, Hind was on the phone with emergency workers pleading for help. 2 paramedics from the Palestinian Red Crescent who responded to her call were also killed in their ambulance. Israel denied responsibility for the killings by claiming its forces were not present. But a new Washington Post investigation finds Israeli armored vehicles were in the vicinity of the attack on Hind Rajab. The Post also reveals the destroyed ambulance was discovered along a route provided by Israeli authorities after the Palestine Red Crescent had received approval to respond. The ambulance was bombed about 164 feet from the car with Hind and her family. The Post reports the destruction of the ambulance was consistent with the use of a round fired by Israeli tanks and that the gunfire audible on the phone call was consistent with Israeli weapons. A coalition of human rights advocates have arrived in Istanbul, Turkey, as they prepare to set sail to Gaza on a civilian flotilla carrying urgently needed food and medicine. Hundreds will participate in the humanitarian aid mission. The Freedom Flotilla is expected to set sail later this month. This is Palestinian-American activist Huwaida Araf.
What we have on board is life-saving aid. We are watching in horror as an entire people are being deliberately starved on top of the bombings and the killings and the maiming that we have seen. And we can't stand by because our governments aren't doing anything to stop it. So we are taking to sea to attempt to deliver this aid and to directly challenge the siege in hopes of breaking it.
Huwaida Araf was one of the organizers of the 2010 Gaza Freedom Flotilla, which Israel attacked, killing 10 activists. Lawmakers can soon take a decisive step in forcing TikTok to either be sold from its Chinese owner ByteDance or be banned in the U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson has attached the TikTok divest or ban measure to a series of military funding bills for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, adding up to $95 billion. House lawmakers are expected to vote on all four bills by Saturday, which would then be sent to the Senate as a single package. This comes as the Wall Street Journal reports the Biden administration's weighing sending another $1 billion in new weapons to Israel, including tank ammunition, military vehicles, and mortar rounds. The U.S. deported over 70 Haitian asylum seekers Thursday, despite a spiraling security and humanitarian crisis in Haiti. Immigration rights advocates have been demanding the Biden administration halt all deportation flights to Haiti. The Haitian Bridge Alliance said in a statement, quote, deportations to Haiti are intentional violence and blatant anti-Black discrimination. The hypocrisy by the Biden-Harris administration must cease, they said. Earlier this week, Haitian officials named the members of a transitional council that will take power after Prime Minister Ariel Henry steps down. The council, made up of voting members and non-voting observers, will choose a new prime minister and wield certain presidential powers by majority vote. Members of the council include a former employee of the World Bank. Its mandate expires February 2026. The Biden administration's reimposed oil sanctions on Venezuela, saying President Nicolas Maduro has not enforced promised reforms ahead of July elections. Some U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry were lifted last year under the condition Maduro allowed opposition candidates to participate in the elections, but several have been banned from running. The U.S. Senate advanced the passage of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, Thursday, despite objections from civil liberties advocates and some Democrats. The controversial provision has been used by federal agencies to conduct warrantless surveillance on U.S. citizens. One of the measure's critics in Congress, Senator Ron Wyden, said, quote, "This issue demands a debate about meaningful reforms, not a rushed vote to rubber stamp more warrantless government surveillance powers," he said. And 12 jurors, 7 men and 5 women, have been selected for Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial. The 6 alternates will likely be chosen by the end of today, with opening arguments starting as early as Monday. Trump's charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide $130,000 paid to adult film star Stormy Daniels in 2016. Prosecutors said Thursday Trump has repeatedly violated his gag order and asked Judge Juan Merchan to hold Trump in contempt. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amidst crackdowns on pro-Palestinian voices on campuses coast-to-coast in the United States, we begin today's show in Israel, where police arrested the internationally renowned feminist Palestinian professor Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian at her home in Jerusalem Thursday on charges of incitement to violence. The professor holds both Israeli and U.S. citizenship. She was suspended by Hebrew University last month after saying in an interview Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. But then the university reinstated her. She spoke on Democracy Now! In March after her suspension.
The question remains whether what is teachable, what is what should be written, what is publishable, what is what we can speak as scholars that are studying state criminality as opposing to what is going on, as opposing to what the state is doing, is not accepted, so they throw us out of the university. And this is the same policy that the state of Israel is doing outside. So it's silencing, it's preventing people from speaking, it's threatening, it's punishing, and it's also done in a very degraded and indignifying manner, calling my student a day before the end of the first semester and telling me you're suspended is something that is beyond any expectations. But this is and stressing it's a Zionist institution, you can't abide by these rules, you're out. My only concern, Amy, today is the safety of students, the safety of my students, Jewish and Palestinian, that are standing against genocide, standing against the war, refusing to see the continuous and ongoing atrocities. My really concern is the silencing of dissent all over the world, because we see it in academic institutions. The question, if we think that academic institutions should work according and by the orders from the state, I don't know why we're having academic institution. Academia and research requires that we're attentive to details, to what goes on, to the life of women, men, children. And I'm really concerned today. And of course, I must clearly state that the behavior of the university is a behavior that is threatening the safety of our students, the safety of colleagues that are speaking against the genocide, and my own personal safety as a person who lives in Jerusalem, and the safety of my family.
That was last month, after Professor Shahoub Kevorkian's arrest on Thursday. Over 100 professors around the world released a statement calling for her immediate release, calling her arrest an attack, quote, on all Palestinian scholars, students, and activists who bring to light the violent and genocidal nature of the Israeli state, they wrote. Today, Professor Shahoub Kevorkian had a hearing where a judge ordered her release, but she has not been released, as the Israeli government is reportedly appealing. For more, we're joined by Sara Ihmoud, a Chicana-Palestinian anthropologist, assistant professor of anthropology and peace and conflict studies at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's founder of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Professor Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian is her mentor. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Professor Ihmoud. If you can start off by giving us the latest. We spoke to her when she was in London after being suspended by Hebrew University. They then reinstated her. She went home to Israel, and she has now been arrested. What have you heard of this hearing and why she was arrested?
Thanks for having me, Amy, and thank you for bringing light to the case of Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, who, as you noted, is an internationally renowned feminist scholar and human rights activist who has been working to bring attention to the situation of Palestinian women and children under Israeli military occupation for the past three decades. As far as we understand, Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian was violently arrested from her home in the Armenian quarter of Jerusalem's Old City yesterday around 5 p.m. The police raided her home and confiscated her belongings, including her laptop, some books from what I understand, as well as a poster of the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, as you noted, has been subjected to violent repression and harassment by the Hebrew University for speaking out against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And she was suspended from her teaching duties in March, though later reinstated once it became clear that there was no basis for the allegations against her. Ultimately, we hold the Hebrew University of Jerusalem responsible for her arrest and detention because of its persistent and public repression of her academic freedom, which led directly to yesterday's arrest. And we see this as yet another example of Israel attacking Palestinians wherever they are, whoever they are. It underscores that no Palestinian is safe under Israel's racist apartheid rule, not even someone like Dr. Shalhoub Kevorkian, who is both an Israeli and American citizen, and a world-renowned and respected feminist scholar. And it's important to note as well that Israel routinely holds Palestinians captive and imprisons them without trial, without due process, and under inhumane conditions, including children, and that this is just both unjust and illegal. And this is an attack on her as both a Palestinian and a scholar who is rightfully speaking out against Israel's well-documented human rights abuses and ongoing genocide. So as far as we understand, the Jerusalem court magistrate had ordered her release under the condition of a 20,000 shekel bail. However, the court, the state, and the police are appealing, and they have taken her to the central court where they're still holding her. So we are still awaiting further details about whether she will be released or whether the state will continue holding her.
Can you talk about how you know her, Professor Sara Ihmoud?
Of course. Thank you, Amy. I have known Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian for over a decade. I first met her in Occupied East Jerusalem when I was a graduate student just beginning to pursue my PhD dissertation research. And she has become one of my dearest friends and mentors over the past decade. She's someone that has really opened my eyes and many across the world to the intimacies of Israeli settler colonial violence and repression in Occupied East Jerusalem, and across the Palestinian territory. Her work has focused on specifically the conditions of women, how patriarchy and colonialism intersect to shape the lives of women, and what justice looks like for Palestinian women. And her work has also really taken a central imperative to understanding the conditions of Palestinian children and speaking out against the persistent human rights abuses of Palestinian children in occupied territory. She is the scholar who founded the concept of unchilding to help us further understand, as scholars across the world interested in children's rights, how settler colonial states typically shape the lives and limit the futures of children, indigenous children and racialized children across the globe. So her work has been absolutely pathbreaking and important, not only in the Palestinian context, but in global contexts where populations are facing racialized and gendered repression and violence. And she has been a beloved mentor to many, including myself. And she has always centered love in the way that she cares for her students, for scholars in her community, and she continues to center that ethics and method of love in the work that she does in the community and with her students across the Hebrew University and beyond.
In addition to being a professor at Hebrew University, she also taught at Queen Mary University in London. We spoke to her in London. Another professor there is Neve Gordon, the Israeli scholar, who we also recently did an interview with. He just tweeted, the judge, Nadra hearing, the judge to police, I can understand that you wanted the arrest to conduct searches, but so far you have not found anything that justifies the arrest, and I have not received any other explanation. The pages you found are an expression of opinion, the judge said. As we wrap up, Professor Ahmoud, the significance of this and why you feel she's being targeted right now.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think, you know, it's important to stress the absurdity of her portrayal by the police as dangerous. And yet this follows a history of Palestinians generally and Palestinian women in particular being portrayed as a dangerous threat to Israeli security. Obviously, we see how the entire population of Gaza has been dehumanized, and that has provided the pretext for Israel's continued genocidal assault on the entire civilian population of the Gaza Strip. And of course, Israel sees Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian as dangerous because her work for the last several decades exposes exactly the opposite, of course, that is the humanity of the Palestinian people in the face of the inhumanity of the Israeli state in its quest to continue to occupy, terrorize, and brutalize the Palestinian people and repress our movement for liberation. So we are calling on international scholars, activists, and people of conscience everywhere to continue maintaining pressure for her immediate release and for all of the charges against her to be dropped. We are outraged by this unlawful action, and we refuse the continuing silence and violence by the Israeli state and its institutions against the Palestinian people. And for those who, like Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, continue being a voice of light and love, standing for justice and liberation. Again, Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian has always centered her love for her people, for her students' safety and security, and it's important that we follow in her footsteps, in the path that she has been taking herself and leading us in embodying hope and the necessity that we continue speaking out against Israel's ongoing genocidal violence.
Sada Ahmoud, we want to thank you for being with us. Chicana Palestinian anthropologist, assistant professor of anthropology and peace and conflict studies at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, where she's speaking to us from. She's a founder of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Professor Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian was arrested Thursday in Jerusalem at her home. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Here in New York, riot police moved in on a peaceful student protest in campus, encampment, arresting at least 108 people at Columbia. Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq called the NYPD to clear the Gaza Solidarity encampment on the campus's South Lawn, where Columbia and Barnard students had set up one day earlier to demand university leadership divest from Israel. New York Police Chief John Chell said Shafiq identified the demonstration as a clear and present danger, but that officers found the students to be peaceful and cooperative. Shafiq warned all students participating in the encampment would be suspended. At least three suspensions of Barnard students were confirmed Thursday before the arrests, including Isra Hirsi, the daughter of Congressmember Ilhan Omar. Thursday's showdown with the NYPD was the largest arrest on the Columbia campus since 1968, when police arrested over 700 students protesting the school's ties to the Vietnam War and its plans to expand in Harlem by building a gymnasium there. Following the arrests yesterday, students gathered on the campus throughout the night as large protests continued and are ongoing. Students got support from many Columbia faculty online and a visit in person from Union Theological Seminary professor Cornel West, just nearby, who's also a 2024 presidential candidate. Democracy Now! Spoke to Professor West after he climbed a fence to visit with the encamped protesters.
You know, in light of our standing deep solidarity with our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters who are undergoing vicious genocide, wrestling with apartheid conditions for so long, and still being ethnically cleansed, we want the world to know that their suffering does not have the last word. There's resilience and there's a willingness to fight. And Columbia president ought to be shame on herself that she cannot zero in on an actual genocide taking place before our very eyes and be concerned about a potential and possible call for genocide of Jews. Nobody here is calling for genocide of Jews. Nobody's here calling for annihilation. We're calling for the end of an actual genocide and the end of an actual annihilation. How sad that Columbia University could teach so many courses on the canonical texts of Western civilization and can't listen to Diderot or Karl Marx. They can't listen to a Martin Luther King Jr. They can't listen to a Muriel Rukeyser. Most importantly, they can't listen to the cries of our precious Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. So I'm in deep solidarity with these students. They represent the best, not just of Columbia, not just of the American Empire, but the human spirit fighting in the face of domination and occupation and subjugation and doing it with tremendous determination.
That's presidential candidate and Union Theological Seminary professor Cornel West speaking to Democracy Now! At Columbia University in the midst of the protests. Special thanks to Hannah Elias. President Shafiq called in the New York police a day after she testified in the U.S. Congress. When we come back, we go to Cairo to speak with a Palestinian photographer who just left Gaza with his family. Stay with us. As Long As I Have by Daughters of Jerusalem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli warplanes bombed areas in Beit Lahia in the northern Gaza Strip, as well as the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza City over the last day, killing at least four people. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports the Israeli military has deployed more troops in areas adjacent to Rafah, the southernmost city of Gaza, where some 1.3 million Palestinians, more than half of Gaza's population, are seeking shelter. Israeli airstrikes have been pounding agricultural land in eastern parts of Rafah this morning. The official death toll in Gaza is nearly 34,000 Palestinians killed, over 14,000 of them children. Thousands more are missing and presumed dead under the rubble. Nearly 77,000 have been wounded. That's 100,000 Palestinians killed or wounded since October 7th. This comes as a picture by the Gaza-based Reuters photojournalist Mohammed Salem has been chosen as the 2024 World Press Photo of the Year. It shows a Palestinian woman, Inez Abu Mamar, caressing the wrapped body of her dead niece, Sally, in the Nasser Hospital morgue in Khan Yunis in October. Well, today we're joined by a Palestinian photographer who was able to leave Gaza 10 days ago with his family. Ahmed Zakot is a photographer who's documented Gaza for the past 25 years. Two of his photographs are featured in a UN OCHA project. Ahmed Zakot joins us now from Cairo, Egypt. Ahmed, welcome to Democracy Now! You've just recently left Gaza. Can you talk about the journey you took and why, as a photographer who's documented Gaza for the last quarter of a century, you decided to leave with your family?
Thank you so much, and I'm very happy to join you today. Actually, what forced us to leave Gaza is to be safe and to keep our family lives safe. As you know, it's a war ongoing since 7 months, and it's a very, very hard war. I'm working since 25 years. This is the first war that I faced. It's a very, very strong war, and we don't know how we are be patient to keep to stay alive during this 7 months. Actually, this war is keeping and still ongoing on Gaza Strip. So each month we talk to us that this war will stop and the international community will stop this war, but actually nothing changed, and the war is still ongoing until this moment.
Ahmed, you left, but you have two brothers, their wives and children. Where are they in Gaza right now? What circumstances are they living in?
Yeah, of course, I left two brothers, wives and their children in Khan Yunis, at the Mawasi area, that the Israeli army said it is a humanitarian area, but actually, nowhere, no place in Gaza Strip are safe, because I was there, and we are, all of us, were lived in tents on this area. This area, it's like a desert, no water, no food, no useful food, and it's a danger area because the Israeli army, by time to time, are targeted at tents and targeted many targets over there. So we are seeking and we are trying to evacuate them from Gaza Strip as soon as possible to follow us here in Egypt to be safe, because, as I said, this war are still ongoing. This situation, my family and all the Palestinians' situation are very, very catastrophic and very, very bad over there. No one can live, and no one can guarantee that he will wake up at the next morning, he is alive or he is not wounded.
Ahmed Zakot, so many of your photographs feature children, also ambulances. Can you talk about your focus right now as you photographed in Gaza these last 6 months?
Yes, of course. Our coverage this war is different about many last wars in Gaza. As you know, Gaza Strip, accord for 4 wars at least, and I covered them, but this war was special, and it's special about me as a photojournalist for 25 years, because the intensive hits, the intensive heavy attacks on the neighborhoods, the cities, the buildings, and also it hits the civilians, the innocent people, actually. So it's different. This is the first time I felt the fear and terror of this war on me and on my brothers, my family, completely, actually. So it's I can't explain this war, because it's a very, very big war. We can say each area that we went at and cover it, we can say it's like an earthquake hit this area, not bombard and bombs hit this area. There are a lot of destruction area buildings or in each single piece and place in Gaza Strip. So we are focusing on children, women, and on the ambulances, teams, and all of the civilians that were hit on this war.
Ahmed Zakhout, two of your photographs are featured in an OCHA project. That's the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. It's a project called Gaza's Carnage Through the Eyes of Palestinian Photojournalists. One of them was taken on October 9th, the other on November 10th. Can you describe these photographs that you chose for this project? In your description of the photograph from October 9th, it says, it was as if flames were spewing from the jaws of Israeli tanks and the F-16 missiles. I took this picture from the 19th floor of a skyscraper in Gaza. In my 25-year career as a photographer, I never felt such fear and distress. I felt that I was filming a cinematic movie scene. I had to remind myself it is all too real. I don't have the words to describe this picture, but I know the terror I felt watching the flames lighting up Gaza in a night drowned in darkness with the electricity cutoffs on Gaza. We're, Ahmed, looking at your picture as you talk to us about it, that picture you took in October.
Yes, of course. This is the first time that I captured such this picture, because as I said as I explained, I thought myself that I'm shooting or capturing a cinematic scene, because this is the first time I saw a heavy of air attacks on a simple area. It was a Rimal neighborhood. It is the beautiful neighborhood in Gaza. And this night, because of the heavy and the intensive attacks from the airstrikes, they are lighting the area. Amid of this darkness, as you know, Gaza are suffering from power cut for many years, since 2006. But this time I felt that Gaza is lighting, but not with electricity, by the lights comes from the bombs of air strikes from the F-16 warplanes. So this picture are still stuck on my mind until now, and will still stuck on my mind for forever, because I felt that really I'm in a cinematic scene, not in a real war that hitting the areas and the buildings over there.
And
this
I wanted
why
to end.
This picture are still stuck and has a story with me.
Ahmed, I wanted to end with your other photograph from November. It is a photograph of thousands of displaced Palestinians fleeing south. You wrote, as I was taking this picture, I remembered my grandfather telling me about al-Nakba and how he was displaced. I started crying.
Yes.
Tell us
about...
Because
I remember this picture. So I was crying. I stopped my capturing pictures at that day, especially because I remembered my grandfather's story that he told me before he passed away in 2002. He told me about the Nakba stages, when the Israeli forces forced them to lift the original cities in Israel to the southern cities in Gaza Strip. So he told me one word, that this scene will not get back at this time. So when I captured this scene, I remember this word from him, that when he told me this sentence, that when he told me before he passed away, that this scene will not get back. But now we are shooting this picture. We are shooting this situation, this displacement for these people, for those people who are suffering, as you see in the picture. They are carrying their belongings at their help and weak hands. So they are fleeing from the northern cities of Gaza Strip to the southern cities. So it reminds me what my grandfather told me about this displacement. It's the same happened since 1948. Now we are in 2024 and 20 or 23, by the way. So this remind me and stuck my heart. I stopped my work and keep crying away from my friends that we are together at that day.
Ahmed, can you talk about how you got out of Gaza with your family? Can you talk about what an adult has to pay something like $7,000-$8,000? It's $2,500 for a child. Explain the circumstances, how you get out, as the Israeli military says it is intent on now attacking Rafah, where people leave from.
So, yes, we are leave Gaza. We are left Gaza by coordinating with the Egyptian press syndicate and the arranging that to me and to my family because I'm a journalist. So they helped me to do that. I appreciated that for them and very thankful for them because they helped me to leave Gaza to Egypt to at least stay for maybe 1 or 2 months until the war will stop. So I will get back to my city, to Gaza, to the Gaza Strip, to keep working and to keep sending messages and to keep covering the sufferings of my people in Gaza Strip.
Ahmed Zakhout, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian photographer forced to leave Gaza with his family 10 days ago. Coming up, we will look at the UN project, the Gaza Collective Photo Essay Project, and the work of more Palestinian photojournalists. Stay with us. Raya Wajay by Huda Asfour. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, I spoke with Charlotte Kanz, head of photography for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, about the Gaza Collective Photo Essay Project she has led. She asked 14 Palestinian photographers to share one image taken in the Gaza Strip over the last 6 months that they want the world never to forget. A warning to our TV audience, the interview features graphic images. She speaks from Paris, France.
Thank you very much, Amy, for having me and having us and talking about this project, which is very special indeed. I think, you know, the first thing is that a couple of weeks into the war, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the situation in Gaza is not just a humanitarian crisis, it's a crisis of humanity. And I think for me, for us, this is what, you know, started it all, because the assault that we're seeing on the population of Gaza is unprecedented in brutality, scope, and intensity. And the figures speak for themselves. In 6 months, you had over 100,000 people killed and wounded, 70% of whom are children and women. You know, this staggering number as well, that the number of children killed in Gaza is higher, in 6 months, is higher than the number of children killed in 4 years of all the wars combined all around the world. You have 3/4 of the population displaced, famine is imminent, law and order are breaking down, humanitarian aid is actively blocked, and on and on and on. And, you know, I think these figures are so staggering that they defy comprehension. And so for me and for us, it was really important to try to humanize these numbers, to make them real and to make them understandable. And I think it's quite paradoxical because there's been an overflow of images and stories on Gaza, flooding our phones, flooding our screens, you know, for 6 months. But somehow it is not cutting across. And I could see it in my direct environment, you know, talking to friends and families. I could see that people didn't really understand what was going on in Gaza. Yes, they know there's a war in Gaza, and they know that wars are bad and horrible. But it's one thing to say there's a war and it's horrible, and it's another thing to see an image of a child being pulled out from the rubble. It really hits you differently. And so I think for us, it was really, as the UN, as OCHA, which is the humanitarian arm of the UN, it was really important to elevate these stories coming from Palestinian photojournalists, who are the only window into what is going on in Gaza, because, as you know, international foreign journalists have been banned of entering Gaza independently. None of them have, except from Clarissa Ward, who went in for like 2 hours at the end of sometime in December. So Palestinian photojournalists are the only ones, are the only window into the suffering of people in Gaza. And so it was really important for us to go to them and to try to share and elevate again the incredible, tragic testimonies that they are reporting and covering day in, day out for the last 6 months.
So, Charlotte Kanz, can you talk about how you reached out to Palestinian photojournalists?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's been incredibly difficult. It's been a process that has been going on for weeks. It took us over 3 months to put this project together. And, you know, as you know, the communications have been really, really difficult with Gaza. I think, you know, it got better recently, but, you know, in December, January, up until February, there were like constant blackouts. So it was hard to get a hold of people, and you would get a hold of someone and then the person would not be responding for days on end. And suddenly you had, you know, an answer and they were like, yes, I'm really happy to participate. I will send you images, and then nothing again for a couple of days. So it was this constant back and forth. And I just want to say here that, you know, the way we made it happen also has been through an incredible photojournalist called Tania Habzhuka, who's been based in Jerusalem, Ramallah, for the past 25 years. Tania is an award-winning photojournalist. She knows the country and the region inside out. And she had an incredible network of you know, colleagues, Palestinian colleagues. And so through Tania as well, we were really able to reach out to a number of them, bring them on board. And, you know, it was a combination of, again, her network, word of mouth. And also, Amy, to be honest, you know, they are being killed also, Palestinian photojournalists. So there are not that many of them left in Gaza, to be honest. And this is tragic.
So introduce us to some of the photographs that are in this collection.
Okay, so I think, let me actually, I'm just taking it in front of me. I think, you know, there's one photo for me that hits me really hard. It's the photo of, from photographer Jihad Al-Frafi. Jihad is a 22-year-old Palestinian photographer from Gaza. And he took this image of Ibrahim, who's a 12-year-old boy, like any other boy in the world, who had his arm amputated because of his injuries in the last 6 months. And we can see him on the image trying to brush his teeth. And he's holding the toothbrush with his mouth and the toothpaste in his left hand. And he's trying to do something as simple as brushing his teeth. And you can see in this image how difficult it is and how his life has been turned upside down. And I think, you know, with the number of children killed in Gaza and wounded, and I think, again, this is pretty unprecedented compared to other conflicts and wars around the world. You know, and when we say, I think it's Save the Children had this terrible statistic a few months ago, which was that 10 children per day on average have lost an arm or a limb in the war. And when you see that, when you see Ibrahim trying to brush his teeth, you understand what that means. It's his life has been shattered, but it's not just his life, it's his family's life as well, because he will need a caregiver for years to come. So again, it's like, you know, through the war, it's entire families who are being affected. And I think this image really hits, you know, very hard to me.
Charlotte, introduce us to Bilal Khaled and his picture.
Yeah, so Bilal is a very interesting, you know, character and person. He's He used to be a calligraphy artist, and he is still a calligraphy artist, but he was, you know, making a living as a calligraphy artist also before the war. He's also a photojournalist. He's an incredible photographer. His images are stunningly tragic very often. There's a couple of images of him in the project. One of them is of a little boy with Amy, the color of ashes. He's sitting on a hospital bed crying, and there's blood, you know, dripping along his face. And Bilal, in the text that accompanies the photo, because that's something very special to this project, it's not just the images, it's the personal text that the photographers have shared to accompany the images, where they explain their emotions and the backstory to the image and what the story means to them. And Bilal has these words with this image. He says that this child, when he got to hospital, was crying for his bicycle. And he kept saying that he wanted his bicycle. He wanted his bicycle, not having fully comprehended what had just, you know, hit him. So this is a really strong image. And then another one from Bilal, which is incredibly strong as well, where you see a family. And I think this is very special, because in many images that we've seen on Gaza, quite often it's one parent or the other with their dead child. But in this image, you see the entire family. You see the mother, you see the father, you see the brother, and you see this dead child in their arms, and their grief and their suffering is so raw in this image. It's incredibly strong.
I wanted to read the quote that Bilal Khalid sent. He said, "A Palestinian child was carried to Al Nasser Hospital, pulled out from the rubble. At the hospital, his aunt recognized him and started screaming his name. This is Dia. This is Dia." When his siblings, mother and father arrived, their pain was unforgettable. He'd left their home to get some wood for heat when he was killed in an airstrike. The yeah. family forms a cocoon around his shrouded small body. Tell us about the photographer Jahan Kowera.
So Jahan is a young female photographer. There's a couple of them in the project. We have three female photographers represented with Jahan. Mariam Abu Dagga and Samar Abu Elouf. So there's three of them. Jahan has this poignant image of a young girl who's lying on a hospital floor. It's a very graphic image. It's very hard. You can see the hands of a health specialist trying to, you know, fix something, her drip or whatever that is. But what is striking in this image is that she's got her right hand lying on the floor, and in her right hand, there's a piece of candy. And it's this, you know, typical candy that kids in many different places of the world eat that is very recognizable. And seeing this young girl, she's probably six or seven, no more, lying on the floor with a piece of candy in her hand. And the quote, again, of Jahan is incredibly, incredibly powerful. And I have it in front of me, actually, Amy. I don't know if I can read it to you. But she says that she could not hold herself up when she saw this little girl gasping for breath, and that the piece of candy still stuck in her hand, stained with blood. She will never forget when she was carried to the mortuary. And she says here, "The candy fell at my feet on the blood-soaked ground." And again, I think what is so strong with this project, again, is that these images hit you because they make this suffering so relatable. These are not just random kids. When you recognize the piece of candy in her hand, you can see all the kids that you know, your own kids, your nephews, your nieces, and that makes it, again, particularly strong.
Can you tell us about Saher Al-Ghoura?
Yes. So Saher has an incredible image in the project where you see a dad, it's in a white tent, screaming. And the dad is in a bit of a hallucinatory state, as he says himself in his text. And right next to him, lying on the floor, is the body of his dead child, covered by a white cloth. And Saher has been documenting the war for the last 6 months for many different outlets. He's a really strong photographer. He just won Picture of the Year, actually. for his work. And again, his, you know, this image is, the suffering is so raw and so, it just hits you, you know, directly. It just stabs you in the heart, really, Amy.
And then there's Mahmoud Hamz. It's similar, but different. He says, Mohamed El Alul is a cameraman for Anadolu News Agency. He is my friend. We spend a lot of time together, and we also often cover the war together. Four of his children were killed in an airstrike, his wife severely injured. When he heard what happened to his family, it was early morning. We were together at the hospital. We went to the morgue at Al-Aqsa. I knew his children. All I could do was to be there with him crying.
Yeah, absolutely. Mahmoud is a photographer for AFP, Agence France-Presse, who's been covering 30 years of war in Gaza. And I think this image is very strong, as you say, Amy, because it talks about, you know, the fact that, again, these Palestinian photojournalists are being killed in this war, and they are not just witnesses, they are victims as well, whether they are being killed or wounded, or whether they are being displaced with their families. And this, again, makes it very, very special in, you know, what we're seeing unfolding in Gaza right now.
And what you know of Mohamed El Alul, the cameraman who lost his children. He's wearing, he's wearing the press vest.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in this incident where his the house where he was staying in got targeted by an airstrike, he lost three of his children and his brother on the strike. So again, we're talking about entire families being decimated.
And Anadolu News Agency, where is it?
So Anadolu is a Turkish news agency. It's one of the big, you know, news agencies, based, headquartered in Turkey.
Tell us about Mohamed Zanun.
So Mohamed Zanun is also one of the, you know, main photojournalists who's been reporting on this war, since the beginning. He's working for several news agencies. He's working, you know, he's been working for Al Jazeera. He's been working for Le Monde. He's been working for a couple of others. His images are all very striking. There's a couple in the project. There's one of where you can only see the feet of a child, and you only see that it's tiny feet in the photo. You don't know who it is, completely buried under the rubble. And Mohamed has this caption which says, "The child's feet were all that were visible from the rubble. The little girl was killed along with three of her brothers by an Israeli airstrike in Han Yunis Market. The mother, she lived, but she was hopeful for hours that they would be pulled out alive by the paramedics from the rubble where her home once stood." And I think this photo is incredible, Amy, as well, because, you know, it's probably, again, when people have seen them, it's one which really stayed with them. It's graphic in a way, but it's not graphic in another. But the emotion that you have when you see this image again, you know, very strong, and it makes you understand again what we were talking about before. What does this war look like day in, day out for people and families and children in Gaza? You know, seeing your child's feet under the rubble, you know, again makes you understand the war quite differently than just reading about it.
Charlotte Cannes, head of photography for OCHA, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. She coordinated the Gaza Collective Photo Essay Project. Charlotte said, these are not just photojournalists. These are also civilians. They're witnesses and victims to the horrible conflict that we're seeing unfolding in front of our eyes. We particularly thank Charlotte for this interview. She was in Paris after the passing of her mother this week. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shurfa Produce, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamer Yasti, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. You're in Pinckney Hall here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Kenny Joe. I will be your radio host for the next hour or so till Zombo comes in. Normally, we start the show with a little song, but we're going to do things a little bit differently today. A little bit differently. A little bit differently for me. I don't know if there'll be much different for you. Anyhow, what we're going to do today is celebrate the release of the Pittsburgh Songwriter Circle Collection 2024. We're going to mostly play music from that collection. We'll also throw in one or two from previous collections and some sort of random new music for you. But we're talking right now because I want to give you a little bit of background on the song that's coming up. It's a song by Pittsburgher Tom Hoffman, which is on the Songwriter Circle 2024 collection, and it is an homage in a way to Utah Phillips. Now, I probably shouldn't assume that everybody knows who Utah Phillips is, but so I'll just mention that Utah Phillips was a singer and a rabble rouser of note who passed away. Well, actually, it's quite a few years ago. Time keeps marching on. And Tom gives the song a nice spoken introduction in the same way that Utah Phillips did with his, 40 or so songs that are on a nice collection called Starlight. Well, it's a nice collection that he and Ani DeFranco put together. Starlight on the Rails, that's what it's called. The memory still works, it's just a little bit slow. So here we go. We're going to start it off with Tom Hoffman's song.
Utah Phillips was a big influence on my taste in music. We could sure use his voice now. He used to sing a song called There's No More Reds in the Union. It was from a time during the McCarthy era when the labor unions purged all the communists from the unions. The folks driven out of the unions were the ones who understood mass organizing and had the vision to build a movement. They were key to the big union drives in the 30s and 40s. His song featured a hapless worker who bought the boss's lie that this purge was a good thing. In fact, it was just another case of the boss successfully turning the working class against itself and crippling the labor movement for years. Today we find ourselves in a similar situation with the ruling class and big oil successfully dividing us against each other over the climate crisis. As an homage to Utah, and with deep respect and gratitude, I offer the following ditty. Oh, big oil, it is so good to me. There's no more snow in the winter. I drive a monster SUV. There's no more snow in the winter. My lifestyle is beyond compare. I feel just like a millionaire. My kids, they march, but I don't dare. There's no more snow in the winter. Now at each year's swell UN affair, there's no more snow in the winter. Big oil and all their friends are there. There's no more snow in the winter. They promise cuts, they seem sincere, but one thing does seem very weird. They broke them in about a year. There's no more snow in the winter. Now they never talk of going green. There's no more snow in the winter. It leads to problems we can't see. There's no more snow in the winter. Now right-wing folks, they've always said, if you like green, you're just a red. So we listen to big oil instead. There's no more snow in the winter. We never talk of storms or floods.
There's no more snow in the winter. My basement is knee-deep in mud. There's no more snow in the winter. Now, oil execs say, don't you fear. Just stay cool, enjoy your beer. It only happens every 100 years. There's no more snow in the winter. Now the air here is the worst I've seen. There's no more snow in the winter. Canadians smoke a whiff of benzene. There's no more snow in the winter. I wear a mask, I stay inside. There's no place safe where we can hide. Oh Christ, here comes a 12-foot tide. There's